Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor, and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Scoop. A great way to start your week is to spend a little time together as we take a look at the big news stories that are in front of us. And we are marking a special moment this week. And it's an arbitrary moment, but it's still special in many respects because since January 20th, the talk has been about the first 100 days in office for the Trump administration. And listen, I'm not going to go too far down that road right now because it's day 99. Okay, but that's what's going to happen this week. There's all this talk about 100 days. Why do we care about 100 days? There's actually a history to it. I will share it tomorrow. But here we are. We have gone through, you know, a certain period of time during this administration where you have the first 100 days and then you have the rest. And one of the significance of this moment, and it bears repeating, even as we go throughout this week and possibly even into the next, is that when you're part of that first 100 days and you're covering it as a member of the media, you're participating it as a member of Congress, you're looking at it from the public perspective, there's somebody else that's still sort of in the background, and that's the previous administration. After that mark of 100 days, then it really truly becomes your administration, whatever that is. It is the administration that you're covering or you're participating in or you're watching again or as a member of the public or experiencing. You're never really watching anything. I really reject that when it comes to the news, that you're just this passive consumer or just watching the news happen from before. No, these things are actually happening to you. They're happening to us. The news is the story that we share together regardless of where we live or our personal perspectives. And that's why the news is really important. It's the stories of our times. And we're going to talk about some of the hot topics that really have been percolating throughout the weekend. And I want to stay focused on these topics, which are really related to immigration. I also want to recognize that the timing of these stories and these topics in front of us, we have to ask the question or at least approach with some skepticism about whether or not this is all just a crazy coincidence. And I'll explain a little bit more about that. One of the things we like to do on Scoop, and thank you to those of you who are joining us live, Robin and Lola and Sherry and Jeremy and Judy and Gretchen and Debbie. It's great to see all of you. Amanda, thank you so much for jumping on live with us. Is I like to talk to you not just as a typical broadcaster sharing the news with you, but also talking about how is the news made? Like, what are the ingredients to making a news story? And what are some of the considerations in delivering this news that affect the way that the public is experiencing them? This way, it's almost a little bit of a news education, because now we can talk to each other about that. It's not your typical format where we have to really work hard for that 23 minutes or 24 minutes of television that's going to cover a 30-minute broadcast, because you have those commercials in there. And everything is geared towards that format. Now we have so many different formats of receiving the news. And I think that really affects the way that we're feeling about it too. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about, well, here's the news story, but here's something else I want you to think about when it comes to how this news actually suddenly wound up in front of you. You know, what questions should we be asking about this? And this helps us kind of understand the timing of different stories and also how that could affect how we're feeling about them too. Before I get to any of that, I actually have a funny anecdote to share with you. Funny? I don't know. Is it a funny anecdote? It wasn't funny at the time. I think it's sort of funny now. As you know, many of you know that I lived in cities until I lived in Texas. and always grew up in an apartment, a flat. You know, I never lived in a house until I moved to Texas in my late 30s. So those of you who have always lived in a house has not been my experience. So because of that, there's a series of different things that have happened over the last several years that come with living in a house and living in the country that I'm still not used to. But here's the news item, because I don't want to just share these experiences. We got to tie it to the news. We're not just going to we got to tie it to the news so that I make sure that I'm just not totally going off on a tangent. Let me show you this. This is actually a map for those of you who are joining us live. For those of you who are not, it's a really interesting article from the Washington Post. Several different news agencies actually wrote about this. It was some new statistics that were released just recently. Has it felt windy to you? The Washington Post asks, see how windy your state was last month. And the reason why this was a story is because it has been unusually windy in America. And the map that I'm showing shows a lot of orange, deep orange, and also sort of this pale orange color. And what that is reflecting is above or well above average for wind gusts if we're going back to 1940. So there's a limitation with some of the data. By the way, that's true of a lot of climate data. Sometimes we get into these political debates about climate change, you know, who thinks it's happening, who thinks it doesn't. A lot of the time it's about the data, you know, how far back does data go? Is it enough to show the context to lead to the conclusions that we're receiving? That's a side note, but the data matters. So the data is going back to several decades, the 1940s. But basically most of us in the United States have experienced a windier than normal springtime. And this has translated into some really big news stories like a higher amount of tornadoes. And I just want to recognize that for a moment. We know that tornadoes, unlike hurricanes, there's no tornado season. We know they can happen during certain conditions more often than other times of the year. But you can have a tornado in January. You can have a tornado in December. It doesn't really matter. It can be more unusual in different times. It doesn't really matter. Some of these tornadoes have been very destructive and very, very deadly. So I do want to recognize that. Here in Texas, where I am, right outside of Austin, we have experienced just these really, really windy days that have been definitely something that's been out of the ordinary. You know, you could have a windy day here or there, but just days on end where the wind is really blowing. And this has produced all sorts of minor sort of nuisances, if you will. For those of you who have allergies around the United States, you might have felt this because you're like, wow, my allergies are really bad this year. Well, the wind has been really bad. So it's carrying a lot of pollen, a lot of things all around. And where I live, there has been an inordinate amount of dust. We've had some work done around the house. We've had dirt piles, which my kids love. But in windy conditions, the dirt is just everywhere. So this is the funny story. This weekend, we thought, you know what? My daughter turned 9 a couple weeks ago. We didn't really have a good moment to throw her a birthday party. On Saturday, we woke up and said, let's do it on Sunday because that's a good idea to do last-minute birthday parties. It's not a good idea. Don't do that. That's the way we're rolling these days, though. So we did a last-minute birthday celebration for her. And we woke up Sunday morning. You know, typically we might go to church and we, you know, kind of get things going for the week. And we thought, well, let's just do a quick dust. Everything's covered with dust. Let's like kind of dust things off. Well, that started a whole thing because we thought we could remove the dust, but no. In the middle of this, I was like, is this how the people felt in the Dust Bowl of the 1930s? Where you couldn't get, it's in everything. You can't get it off. You can't spray it down. You can't power wash. I mean, we're doing all the things. We are hard labor, scrubbing, squeegee. I mean, we're just trying to get a place where people can sit down. this is what it's like. You know, hours are going by. We didn't get to church. We didn't get to the grocery store. You know, like we're just trying to survive at this point. We got people coming over at 3. Anyhow, the reason why this is actually funny is just like 5 minutes before people arrive, I thought, oh, I probably should take a shower. I mean, we've been like sweating, you know, the whole thing. We got it sort of okay. It's still everywhere. It's still like, it's still sort of a mess, but we got it to at least an area where people could sit down. And so I decided not to take a shower. I was like, yeah, this is it. We're going to roll the dice. It's going to be fine. The kids are going to be running, playing, jumping, doing all sorts of things. It doesn't matter. We're just going to relax. So I didn't take a shower. Later that night, my son comes in. He's like, hey, we have no hot water. There's no hot water. Turns out, not only is there no hot water, there's no propane. For those of you who live on where you have gas that's heating your house or running your stoves, this again is a country thing. It's not something that a city girl like me that knows about those things. We're completely out of propane. The company hadn't been here for like, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. We didn't realize that we couldn't use our stove. Thankfully it wasn't cold, you know, it was fine, but it was just a moment where you think, I'm not prepared for this. You know, you give me something about foreign policy. You want to talk about Russia and Ukraine? You want to talk about terrorism, foreign terrorist organizations? Like, I'm your girl. You want to talk about propane and removing dust? Like, I'm not that person. I'm that person that's on Instagram or YouTube trying to get those cheat sheet videos for you. You know what I mean? Like, what? Tell me how to do this. Anyhow, the propane guy arrived this morning. I will shower at some point. I also am a wimp because I was like, I can't do it. I don't want to do the cold plunge. I don't want to do the cold shower. I can't do it. My mom nerves are frayed. It's the end of the school year. I just can't do it. These are first world problems. I understand that. But I feel like by sharing them, we become closer. And that is what this insider group is, what this is all supposed to be about. So thank you for allowing me to get that out, tie it to a little news. If you are experiencing windier than normal conditions, is that affecting parts of your life perhaps in a serious way, non-serious ways as well? It is true. So you're not just like, it's not just make-believe. These are actual statistics that it is actually windier than normal. So there you go. There's a little bit of news. And if anyone has advice about power washers, no, I'm kidding. We have one. We have one from Home Depot. I'm not a good power washer. I don't know. Here we are. Ashley saying crazy that the dust is so bad. It's totally true. Thank you. Gretchen says, I feel you, Jenna, you got this. I really appreciate that. Robin. Oh man, a house full of guests and no propane. Here's the thing, Robin, our gas grill's attached to it too. We're worried we have a leak. That's the other thing. I don't think it's anything, fingers crossed, dangerous, but it is strange. We were able to power the grill. We had hot water during this event, this extravaganza. But none afterwards. So clearly we did something, but also we need a delivery of propane probably sooner than we were getting it. So we're just working it all out. You know, in a city, you just like, if you don't have power, no one has power. If you don't have hot water, like multiple people in your building don't have hot water. Sometimes you can call somebody, right? That's my husband's like, you miss having like a doorman in a building. I'm like, yes, I do. Although I lived a long time in New York City without a doorman. By the way, a doorman is very typical. It's not just like the fancy buildings that have them. You know, if you're in a building with like 100, 200, 300, 400 units, you're usually there's someone there. I'm like, do I have to boil water? Am I going to get a fire going outside? Amy's saying, did I do something wrong? How we know you're not from Texas, we say propane. What did I say? Did I say something weird? I feel like propane is propane. Did I say it strange? Anyhow, I have that San Francisco accent, you know, to some of you folks. Okay. Let's get to the news. There are two stories I want to focus on today because these are the ones that are really absorbing a lot of attention in the news, probably across your social media. And they deserve a little bit of attention because they're very unique. The timing of these stories is something I want to approach with some healthy skepticism, as I mentioned, because they came up Friday going into this weekend, or we learned about them over the weekend. And this is going into a week where the Trump administration really wants to talk about what they consider to be wins. So today we wake up. Normally the press secretary will say, okay, we're going to have a press briefing around 1 o'clock, for example, 1 o'clock Eastern time, around that time period. But no, we have a press briefing at 8:30 Eastern time, highly unusual. And guess who's going to be there? It's one of the positions in the administration. I don't love the way that this term is used, but it's the easiest way to understand a role. He's often referred to as the border czar, Tom Homan. And so they clearly are there to talk about immigration. Now, we had these stories, again, kind of break on Friday, go into the weekend, hear more about them. Now it's Monday morning. The press is completely kind of absorbed by them, including myself. And now the White House is going to drive that news story further because they are going to step to the microphones early in the news day. What does that do? That dares the networks, that dares the journalists not to include their latest statements on this topic because they're making that availability there for the networks. So here's some of the editorial calls that have to be made. If you're Good Morning America And you have the latest Hollywood star coming on at 8:30, but you have the White House also with some news. You don't want to move the Hollywood celebrity. That's kind of the bread and butter advertisement that hour. But you also, if you want to be a news organization, you want to pay attention to that. So you start maybe moving things around. Okay, maybe you'll take a couple minutes at the press briefing. You're going to move that cooking segment to tomorrow. We're going to take the big interview, or maybe not. Maybe you're going to ignore the White House and say, we're not going to do that. For the cable news networks or 24-hour news sources, the likelihood is that they're going to dip into this press briefing live and take some of it, meaning they're going to take some of it live. Again, this is a way that any administration is going to get quickly into the bloodstream of that news cycle for the day and start driving the news. So this is why, as I'm watching this, I thought, oh, this is really an interesting sequence of events, because the Department of Justice arrested a judge in Wisconsin on Friday, you know, going into the weekend. We had the news of another judge arrested and charged in New Mexico around the same time period. You have the news of mothers that were in the country illegally deported, and with them were also their American children when they were deported. We would not say the children are deported, because in order to be deported, that's actually a legal process. But the children can accompany their mother if the mother desires that to be the case. And in that way, the children also went with the mother when they were deported. We'll get into all these stories with some of these specifics. These are very unusual stories related to immigration. In fact, we haven't covered any of them really like this recently. I don't know if I've ever covered a judge arrested regarding immigration proceedings. And for that reason, here we are talking about immigration again. Again, the president's marking 100 days in office. This is a promise of his administration, a secure border and a different way of enforcing existing law. That's part of the key of these stories. Law can exist, but there's always a question of whether or not it can be enforced. So there's a speed limit. I mean, maybe this isn't exactly the law, you know, exactly all the same. They're not all even on the table. But let's just say the speed limit, right? Anyone that goes over the speed limit is technically breaking the law. You could be ticketed for that. But some of us go over the speed limit 2 or 3 miles per hour, maybe 5. And you're rolling the dice. But, you know, you could get pulled over. You could get a speeding ticket and you could be punished for doing that. The question is really about enforcement. You all know the areas where you live where there's police by the road. And you know where you really have to watch driving the speed limit and where there's usually no police at all. And you can kind of estimate. That's really the question with law in America regarding immigration too, is that there's a lot of a law regarding immigration and legal status on the books. The question has been the federal government's capacity to enforce the law or the will to. And so when I'm talking about President Trump's administration, you're talking not necessarily about new laws. You're talking about enforcing existing laws in a different way, perhaps a more disciplined approach, perhaps as far as federal overreach, some would describe as too aggressive or a type of a posture from the federal government that feels like overreach into locales. That's the second part I want to talk to you about before we get into the specifics of these cases. There's always been tension between the federal government and local and state governments regarding immigration. You can look at the border as a simple issue that, and it's not simple, but it's a simple issue to look at. You know, as a federal government, who's responsible for policing the border? Can the federal government just march into state land, take it over and say, this is for us to patrol? And if you're a local owner of this land, well, really technically this is the border. So this is where we're going to set up and this is the sort of rules we're going to enforce, but maybe the state's not going to force a different rule. The kind of the combinations or the collages of these, the laws look different in different states. How California is going to enforce its immigration laws is going to look different than the state of Texas. The federal government also has a certain goal or perspective depending on the administration, and the way that these forces interact can sometimes be messy, to say the least, or certainly can lead to some tension. So let's talk about each case. And then if you have any questions, we can go through some of them. Some of these cases, we have a limited amount of information. And I also want to preface, I have sound from the federal government. I don't have sound from some of these defendants, at least not yet. So I always would like to show you, let's say, the attorney general, and then show you the lawyer for the judge, but I don't have that video. And so just be aware that you're going to get more from the federal government than you are from the other side. And I'm going to try to balance that out with some statements, but just so you're aware of it, I want to be aware of it too, because sometimes if that's all that we have playing in our head, then that's what we think the story is. So here is an ex post from the FBI director, Kash Patel. This is again coming from Friday. You see a woman in handcuffs being led to a car. You have two people with their face blacked out, or so you can't see who they are. And the comment on X is, no one is above the law. No one is above the law. Here is Attorney General Pam Bondi talking about this case. Notice the language that she is using.
Above the law. In Milwaukee, an illegal alien from Mexico was in court being prosecuted for domestic violence. He was charged with violently attacking a man, punching him in the face 30 times, strangling him, and then attacking a woman by punching her in the face with his closed fist. Both victims were brave enough to be in court. The judge, Hannah Dugan, learned that ICE was outside to arrest him after court. She is now charged with obstruction of justice for sneaking this criminal defendant, an illegal alien, out a back exit through her chambers to avoid his arrest, leaving the victims and prosecutors sitting in court all morning waiting on justice.
So that was actually the case in Wisconsin when Pam Bondi's talking about Judge Dugan. Here's the scenario that the Justice Department is mapping out. Apparently, this person in question shows up to court to face charges. They're with their lawyer. Also showing up in court in the outside of the courthouse, or in the courthouse, but not in the courtroom, are these ICE agents that are presumably there because the person in question being charged with the crime does not have legal status to be in the United States. So they're facing a crime. They don't have legal status. Now you have these agents there. The judge learns of this. She actually talks to the agents. She doesn't like what's going on. She's like, you can't just walk in here and arrest. You got to go do this and this and this. You come back and then maybe, you know, there's some exchange. I'm just summarizing here. As this is, when she goes back to the courtroom, she basically allows the defendant, according to the Justice Department, this is not her side of the story, to go through a jury door into an area that's not public. So you and I can't walk there in the courthouse. And then they use that area, the defendant and his lawyer, to exit the courthouse. The ICE agents find them. They actually chase them down on the street and arrest them. And now the judge is being charged with obstruction because of those actions that she took. They're saying you were aiding someone that we were trying to arrest. She could face upwards of a combined 6 years in prison for some of these charges. Her lawyer obviously denies how this all went down. We don't have his statement again on camera. But she's going to appear in court in the next like 15 days. I think it's May 15th is the day that she's going to be back in court, and we'll hear more about the case. But this is the argument from the Justice Department. This is the actions that she reportedly took that led to these charges. Now, I want you to hear about the judge in New Mexico, which is a different situation. Again, these are very unique cases. So I want you to hear how the Attorney General is describing these.
Mexico. Law enforcement was tipped off that Judge Joel Cano had a TDA member living in his home. The judge and his wife allegedly gave him access to assault rifles, one with a suppressor, to go to a shooting range to perfect his skills. Law enforcement found pictures on his cell phones and social media showing multiple tattoos and gang insignia. They also found a picture of him with the judge. He had mocked a $5,000 reward to catch TDA members. They also had pictures of two victims who had been decapitated. Their hands were cut off, and their bodies had also been mutilated. The judge, now charged with obstruction. Post-Miranda, he admitted he destroyed one of the cell phones with a hammer and then took it to a city dumpster down the street to dispose of the evidence. The Trump administration will fight for victims.
So there you have the Attorney General talking a little bit about this case in New Mexico, completely different situation. Again, there's some specifics that are lacking. We don't know the age of the defendant here, although we know that the judge in the case who resigned in March previously to this, actually these charges being filed, calls them boys. Apparently there is this defendant, the person in question, I should say, the person without legal status, was one of a few people that were living on the property of the judge. And what you get from reading local news that I'm going to summarize here, local news from New Mexico, in a statement that the judge gave the Supreme Court there is he says, I just thought I was basically helping these young people. And I have grandchildren. I would not have someone on the property that I think is dangerous or that could be associated with a gang. The TDA, Tren de Agua, is the gang that the Attorney General is mentioning. Those gangs, these specific gangs, have been categorized as foreign terrorist organizations by the Trump administration. That is a change. That is up to an administration to be able to do, kind of have these classifications. And so for this reason, this judge and his wife face upwards of 20 years in prison for this variety of different charges related to this. And one of the keys to this particular case, and this again, the details are a little murky, this is what the Justice Department says, is that the person, the young man that is on the property that is allegedly a gang member, had like 3 or 4 cell phones. And the judge had access to one of them. And apparently before law enforcement showed up, he smashed that phone so that the law enforcement would have access to it. There's a lot of parts to this that you're just wondering, well, what's actually going on here? And it's difficult to know without more of a statement. Carrie, you asked a question. Let me go back up here and see if I can grab it. It was a good question. Why do we have more from the federal government than defendants? The federal government has released a variety of different things. So they have press releases that are summarizing the charges. That's something I'm getting officially from the .gov website. This is an official government press release or document. I have a statement coming from the Attorney General. I have social media posts from the Attorney General as well as the FBI director. They're giving me a lot to work with. The attorneys and the defendants, so the judge, for example, in the case in Wisconsin, or the judge in New Mexico, to my knowledge, have not done any on-camera interviews. So then I have a limitation of video or sound I can choose from because I don't have their voices. There are lawyers in some cases, for example, in Wisconsin, appeared in court. But again, if that's not on camera, then I don't have access to it. So there's a limitation to providing all the sides here other than to say, well, these defendants in these cases deny it. You know, they deny these charges. So this is where we're sitting with these cases right now. Again, highly unusual and raises this broader question that's come up during the Trump administration, during this time period in office, about the posture of the federal government. The federal government has repeatedly said under the Trump administration that no one is above the law and that the law will be enforced and people will be prosecuted. And this is an example of that, that the Department of Justice is using, saying, hey, judges, if you do things that break the law, just because you're a judge doesn't mean that you're protected. To some, that is a chilling effect, an intimidation for judges across the country that says, if you don't fall in line with our policies, then you're going to be prosecuted. In these specific cases, these aren't policies. These are laws that the Department of Justice is saying that these defendants broke. And certainly everyone's innocent until proven guilty. But it's not a matter of policy. There is a broader question, though, about policy in general and whether or not the Trump administration is requiring a loyalty, even at the local level, that feels like intimidation. And again, I'm using sort of general language, which I don't love, but I'm trying to summarize both sides and how both sides feeling here. One side says, hey, we're upholding the law. The other side says, wait a minute, like part of the judicial, you know, there's 3 equal branches of government. The judiciary is one of them. The judges are there to make calls based on certain cases and due process, and that matters. And so why did the judge feel, for example, that she had to or felt compelled to give this defendant who didn't have legal status in the United States that was being tried for a crime related to domestic violence a way to perhaps evade federal law enforcement? So then we have a clash between the feds and the local law enforcement. For anyone that's seen an episode of Law and Order, sometimes you see that, right? when the NYPD in that show is annoyed because the FBI showed up and now it's their case. And like, wait a minute, it's our case. So kind of like a pop culture example, but there we see it play out. Does anyone have any questions on this particular case? It's as far as we know right now. Natalia is asking, do you have any other background on these judges? Not a ton right now. Natalia, it's something that we're going to be looking into. In the Wisconsin case, the judge was elected to this position. In some cases, that happens for judges. And Ashley's saying that these are very unusual storylines, which I can attest to, absolutely. So, oh, and Jackie, welcome. Jackie's saying, happy to finally join a live. Been an insider for years now, but my kids finally have overlapping naps and quiet times. Oh, come on, Jackie. That's amazing. Thank you for spending some time with us. We all know what that's like when you can do a little something, listen to something. So we're trying to make this as efficient as possible for you. All right, let's move on to this other case that we're getting. If more questions come up as you're thinking about these cases, but I want you to have an idea of a little bit of a foundation for these cases regarding judges, because they're going to come up and we're going to see what happens next. And we'll see, do these how much does the Justice Department pursue these charges? Because it's one thing to charge someone with a crime. Then you got to figure out, are you actually going to go through with it? Are you actually going to prosecute them? Nothing to indicate that they won't, but let's see what's going to happen. Okay, let's talk about these cases regarding children that are part of a family where, according to the information that we have, the women, the mothers, were not in the country illegally. They were in the country illegally, or they did not have legal status. Why do I use that language? I use that language because we don't really know that much. There's a series of different families here that are part of this overarching news story. And the children have different cases. You might hear of a child that had cancer, that was receiving cancer treatment. That was one child belonging to one mother. There's another child that's belonging to another. There's a couple different families. And that's hard to kind of lump them all together. The reason why that's hard and not great for us right now, and again, maybe in the next couple hours we learn more, is that we really want to understand, were the women in the country without legal status, meaning that, let's say they were encountered coming across the border. They were trying to come across the border illegally. Border Patrol saw maybe they were part of a large group like we've seen in recent years. I'm just playing out a scenario. Border Patrol sees a woman. She says, I'm being persecuted in my home country. Border Patrol says, okay, do you have any family here? She says, yes, it's in this area. And they said, okay, here's your file, and here's where you need to report. When you get to your family, wherever you are in the country, then you need to report because you have a case now. And that case is going to decide whether or not she's allowed to stay in the country legally because she's pursuing asylum, or maybe she's not. Those cases can take many, many years. Now, that's one scenario, is that a woman seeking asylum, and she feels she has a legitimate reason to do that. There could be others that are trying to pursue asylum that know maybe they don't have a claim, but are hoping that their claim allows them to stay in the country for several years. And then maybe they get in front of a judge that, because they have family here, because now maybe they have children here, they have a more sympathetic case, and then they're given permission to stay. Like, we don't know any of these scenarios. We just know that these women were not American citizens, and they were actually doing a routine check-in, as is required if they are pursuing asylum or their case to stay has come up on the docket. They were doing what they were supposed to do. They were showing up to report and to check in. And as they were doing it, they had their children with them. We don't know what transpired, and we don't know why suddenly they were giving deportation orders. But a person can appear before a judge, and the judge can say, you don't have a case here. You actually don't have permission to stay in the country any longer. You are going to be removed. You're going to be deported. And at that time, if a child is with someone, that person is going to be taken essentially into custody, and they're going to be removed from the country. The speed of that is kind of like all over the map. I don't have great visibility on that. In fact, it's one of the questions, I have a list of questions going to the Department of Homeland Security. My hunch is it sort of depends on the judge. It depends on the administration. You know, you could be given a deportation order and maybe it wouldn't happen immediately. In this case, it did. And according to the federal government, these women were given a choice. Do you want your two-year-old to go to your husband, or do you want your two-year-old to come with you? What do you want? You're going to need to make a decision. You got to sign on the dotted line and tell us what you want to do. What do you want to do? And in these cases, again, according to the federal government, the women said, I want my child, my young child, to come with me. That child, in these cases, at least in, not all of the children, but some of the children were American citizens. And so that's why you're hearing American citizens deported, but the American citizen was not deported. The person without legal status was deported. The child was removed with them. It's an important distinction because deportation is thrown around as a word that people use, but you really need a legal process for it. It's not like we kind of, we'd use this so casually, but in order to officially be deported, you have to go through a process. There's also removal that can happen. So under Title 42, for example, that was happening during the pandemic. If a border agent encountered someone that doesn't have an asylum claim, that really shouldn't be in this country, they could remove them quickly. The government empowered them to do that. So it wasn't officially a deportation proceeding, but because of the law and the emergency law under the pandemic, we could quickly remove them from the country without an official deportation proceeding. So the words really matter here, and we're far too casual about it in the media, and it can give the wrong impression that American citizens are being deported. No, American citizens are not being deported, but the parent in this case chose to bring their American citizen child with them. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was asked about this on one of the Sunday shows, and he said, listen, if the children want to come back, they're American citizens, they should be allowed back in the country. But as any family is thinking about this, if you have a two-year-old, you know, are you going to put them on a plane by themselves? Like, how does that happen? So there's a practicality sense to it. Here is this morning, this is Tom Homan talking on this issue. I want you to hear how he's answering this question.
There were three U.S. citizen children who were removed with their mothers who were in the United States illegally. There have been a federal judge in Louisiana who was appointed by President Trump said that he was concerned that there was, quote, no meaningful process. Are you concerned that due process, at least for the U.S. citizen children, is being flouted and that the speed at which the enforcement is being done could lead to errors?
As far as the U.S. three OC kids, I'd said from day one that if you enter this country legally, it's a crime. If you remain in this country legally and you ignore a judge's order about deporting, if you choose to have a U.S. citizen child, knowing you're in this country legally, you put yourself in that position. You put your family in that position. What we did is remove children with their mothers who requested the children depart with them. This was a parental decision. Parenting 101. The mothers made that choice. And I tell you what, if we didn't do it, the story today would be Trump administration separating families again. No, we're keeping families together. So when a parent says, I want my two-year-old baby to go with me, we made that happen. They weren't deported. We don't deport U.S. citizens. The parents made that decision, not the United States government. But I don't hear any questions about Lake and Riley had a mother. She's never going to see her child again. Rachel Morin, she had five children. You know, those children are never going to see their mom again. This administration is doing the right thing. Every public safety threat we are in this country and will them, this country is much safer. So parents will make a decision what happens to their child. Having a U.S. citizen child does not make you immune from our laws. If that's the message we send the entire world, enter the country legally. It's a crime. Don't worry about it. Get order removed by an immigration judge. Don't worry about it. No one's looking for you. And have a U.S. citizen child and you're immune from our laws, you're never going to fix the border. People will keep putting themselves in harm's way. More women will die. More children will die crossing this border. We got to secure a border by enforcing laws. We're not making this up. We're enforcing laws under statute enacted by Congress, and it's the right thing to do.
Tom Homan started his address in the briefing room talking about 40 years of experience that he's had in this particular area. And he's very emotional and passionate when he talks about this topic. It's that way in interviews. It's that way today in the press briefing room. It's very consistent. He clearly has a passion for this topic, which he believes that an unsecure border leads to more crime and those criminals preying on the vulnerable, which include women and children. So just a little background into what he's saying there. He's talking about we need to make sure that there's a deterrent, because if we don't, then we're also sharing responsibility for encouraging this human trafficking and the abuse of women and children because we're not securing the border. That's his philosophy. There are those that don't agree with the Trump administration's philosophies. And to your point, I saw Melissa said this. She said, I wouldn't even say the child was removed with them. The moms chose to bring them. It's a very, very different emotional response from the public, depending on the word choice. Absolutely. You can see how I'm struggling describing it. Do I say, well, the mom brought them with her as she was deported. The mom chose to bring the child with her. One of you asked, let's see as well, it was a good question here about the father and whether or not there was a father involved. That's another twist to one of the cases of whether or not the women were able to reach out to family members to explain what was happening and then to appropriately give the family members time to come get the children. There was also a question about whether or not the father had legal status in one case and whether or not that legal status could appropriately be given to another family member. So imagine that scenario. Also, if you're law enforcement or also if you're the mother, signing away your right to the child to a distant aunt or somebody that they know or don't know. It's a very complicated situation. The stance of this administration, similarly to the first term of the Trump administration, is to take a rather, could be, depending again on your point of view, controversial stance on this. When it was the first administration, it was child separation, family separation. If you come across the border, that's breaking the law. If someone's arrested in America, I don't get arrested with my child. My child is taken somewhere else into custody and I am separated from them. Same thing happens to you. If you come across the border illegally, this is what we're going to do. We know that was a controversial policy. You had mothers and children and families separated. And a question about how they're reunited, that law, that policy was not allowed to stand. In this way, you can, did you hear what Tom Homan said? He says, we're not separating families, we're keeping them together. So they've turned that policy on the head in the way that they're telling it. And they're saying, well, the families are staying together, but the mom doesn't have legal status, so she has to leave. Either way, both of these policies, controversial as they may be, depending on the audience, is part of a plan for deterrence. Do not come into the country illegally. Otherwise, there are consequences. This is what the Trump administration said at the beginning. This is how they're enforcing it. Whether or not there is a legal challenge to be had here, you know, whether or not there was not due process, whether or not this isn't legal the way that how quickly the deportation happened, we will find that out in the next several days to see what happens now. But again, these scenarios came up right before we're going into Mark 100 days in office. And here we are sitting with these two stories, the judges being arrested, families allowed to stay together as long as the mother is leaving because she doesn't have legal status, and border numbers. So let me just show this to you really quick because I do think we talked a little bit about this last week, but I always want to go back to it to show you the nationwide encounters. I was taking a look at this because I thought it would be interesting to again pull out this particular, I could pull down this menu of who are the demographics of people being encountered at the U.S. borders. And I'm clicking accompanied minors and basically family units. And what you can see in this red line here under the Trump administration is how far this went down. So when it comes to accompanied minors, so that some, you know, a minor traveling with an adult or a family unit, it went from 22,000, almost 23,000 nationwide in January to 2,000 in February to 1,600 in March. So there was a thinking when we were seeing these record numbers. So let's go back. Let's see. Go back to 2022. I'm going to again go back and click just accompanying minors, family units. And I'm going to go back to 2022, March 2022. Okay, a couple of years ago, height of the Biden administration, you had nearly 40,000 accompanied minors or family units coming in, or I shouldn't say coming into the country, those that were actually encountered by Border Patrol. We don't know the total number. We just know the number of those encountered. Last year, it was almost 81,000. 81,000. In March, it was 1,600. So this is the difference of policy and enforcement of laws. And if deterrence is part of it, that it's this is what we're seeing is the consequence of that. And you can see it in the numbers. I mean, the drop from, geez, think about that, 81,000 to 1,600. It gives you something to think about. Again, controversial. You're going to have a lot of people say that this is overreach. It's the government's taking, they're not being, and this was brought up in the press briefing, and even in the Sunday shows, this question of exception, like if someone has a sick child, is there an exception there? Like, what about humanitarian concerns? Like, you know, what about just taking a look at that family unit and deciding, does that mother actually need to go or should she be able to stay? You know, you're talking about in a lot of different scenarios here. One case I talked to you about today, we're talking about an alleged gang member, or we're talking about a person that's being charged with domestic violence. And then you have a mother that maybe doesn't have legal, that clearly doesn't have legal status, but is trying to do the right thing and show up for a routine hearing. And then perhaps her claim is not justified. And so she doesn't have the right to stay. So how do you look at these cases individually, and what's the right way to do that? You know, how is the law applied? Does it have to just be applied across the board straight, or are there exceptions? And it can be tough to kind of think about those exceptions, right? That's a good question. Mommy's asking, can you deep dive into what the border laws actually are, or share where we can read them? It's hard to find with all the junk that comes up in a search. It's a great question. And that would be something that would be worth maybe pulling out three of the most important border laws. Let me just give you this perspective. I know I've mentioned it before, but it bears repeating, because every time I say it out loud, I can't believe it, but it's important. If I cross the border, if I do not have legal status and I cross the border, I am potentially guilty of a federal crime. That federal crime of coming into the border illegally, coming across the border illegally, carries with it less of a punishment than if I cut down a tree on federal land as an American citizen. So think about that. The law as it's written right now, doesn't mean I broke the law coming into the country, but the punishment that comes with it is softer than if an American citizen does something like goes into Yosemite and decides to chop down a tree. Those are the laws. So what about, you know, that's up to Congress. That legislation's up to Congress. How it's enforced depends on the federal government for law enforcement or local government, which is where we're getting into some questions about sanctuary cities and whether or not those cities or those areas decide not to enforce certain laws. So it's a rich topic. There's a lot to go over and a lot to consider. And I'm curious your thoughts on that. You know, what exceptions should be made? How do you make those exceptions? How are they applied? Who qualifies? You know, what does that look like? Gretchen's saying, so wild that the laws can sort of be chosen to be enforced or not enforced. It's part of the policy of an administration. It is interesting when you think about it, because I don't know about you, when I was young, you think the laws of the land are the laws of the land. You're going to go to prison just if you breathe wrong. Maybe that's just me. My parents put that into my psyche to keep me on the straight and narrow. It worked. I was scared. Okay, I want to show you one last thing real quick. And this is sort of related to this idea of the media and also, you know, how we're approaching things at Smarter News. If you have any other questions, please let me know. I'll make sure to answer them before we wrap up here. I'll let you think a little bit. I want to show this to you. So there's been a question about a few different choices by the Trump administration regarding media and regarding law. And we could kind of link them in this way of a question about federal overreach. You know, is the federal government reaching into areas that really the federal government should not be, either legally? And those are the questions with DOGE, for example, or the federal firings, or just in a way that doesn't feel good or quote unquote American, depending on those, your opinion. And it, of course, there's a lot of different opinions on these topics. So, you know, there's a question of intimidation. Is there an intimidation factor here by the Trump administration for judges that, like we just talked about, you know, yeah, for judges that aren't breaking the law, they're not really being targeted, but it's the fact that the federal government is willing to prosecute a judge have a chilling effect that makes some judges fall in line with the administration's policy when otherwise they would be acting more independently. It's a fair question to ask. This has also come when up in media as well. And I want to show this to you. I pulled it from Instagram, so you're going to see that. It was the final minute and a half of 60 Minutes, one of the most prominent news magazine shows in America. And I want you to hear what Scott Pelley says about the recent departure of an executive.
Last minute, a note on Bill Owens, who until this past week was executive producer of 60 Minutes. He was our boss. Bill was with CBS News nearly 40 years, 26 years at 60 Minutes. He covered the world, covered combat, the White House. His was a quest to open minds, not close them. If you've ever worked hard for a boss because you admired him, then you understand what we've enjoyed here. Bill resigned Tuesday. It was hard on him and hard on us, but he did it for us and you. Stories we pursued for 57 years are often controversial. Lately, the Israel-Gaza war and the Trump administration. Bill made sure they were accurate and fair. He was tough that way. But our parent company, Paramount, is trying to complete a merger. The Trump administration must approve it. Paramount began to supervise our content in new ways. None of our stories has been blocked, but Bill felt he lost the independence that honest journalism requires. No one here is happy about it, but in resigning, Bill proved one thing. He was the right person to lead 60 Minutes all along.
So that's the comments coming from Scott Pelley. A few just observations in those comments. Number one, when people talk about corporate media, Scott Pelley's references to Paramount is what the corporate media is. So wherever I have worked, there's been a corporate parent company. When I was at Fox News, Fox Business, that was News Corporation. When I was at local New York One in New York City, that was Time Warner at the time. When I was at Forbes, you know, Forbes obviously is a big company. That was sort of this parent company, overarching parent company with a certain philosophy. All of these different parent companies had an approach to the news. And there were some editorial pressure coming, depending on the topic, from that parent company. That is the corporate media. When we're talking about corporate media, that's what it is a corporate structure that's influencing either directly or just by oversight. That's what Scott Pelley was just talking about, that can start, you know, pushing down or changing the editorial decisions of a journalist. That's working within the corporate media structure. That's the effect of it. It happens everywhere. It's one of the reasons why independent media is so important, because I don't have a corporate partner. I don't have a parent company. I am the parent company. And the supporter of our organization is you. So if there's anyone I'm answering to, it's the public. It's you. It's especially you, our Scoop insiders, that are choosing to support us because you're providing an investment in what we're doing so that we can grow. That's the difference, though. So for what Scott Pelley is describing there is not unique to 60 Minutes. And what really stood out to me of what he said is that none of the stories have been blocked. So he didn't suggest that stories are not airing because of Paramount. He did suggest that Paramount is watching because they want to make sure that a merger will take place. And for that, they need federal approval. So there seems to be this inference, a comment to say, well, we're getting more oversight because Paramount doesn't want to come up sideways with the Trump administration and blow up this deal. That's the reality of working in corporate media. Like that's what it is. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but it's everywhere. And that's what makes Smarter News really, really different. It's the importance here of understanding who you actually work for and who pays your bill, who pays your check, who's paying your salaries. And if it's the corporate media, then you have to answer to somebody. It's one of the reasons why through Smarter News, when we started Scoop, there was a real question here about whether or not I would have to seek outside investors, which I did not want to do. My family, me, we are the financial backing of Smarter News at the beginning. And there's been a lot of speed bumps to that. Part of starting Scoop was an answer to your complaints, which were that we don't want to just be on social media. Don't want to deal with the comments. We want more live events. We want to be able to interact and to be able to serve you more efficiently and also more precisely, and to really use your time well. I know this is a longer broadcast than we normally do, but I really think this is important to talk about. This is one of the reasons we started Scoop. People were asking, how can we support you? We would like to send you money. And I didn't have a way to do it. And so becoming a Scoop insider, buying us a cup of coffee once a month has been a game changer for us. If we can grow a little bit more, it will completely change the landscape of Smarter News. But every quarter, every couple months, someone comes to me and says, you have to get a corporate partner. You have to get an outside investor. You're not going to be able to move. And believe me, I have felt that way this year specifically of like, oh, we would have been able to move faster. We've been able to hire people more. We would have been able to go fast, go, and grow. And did I miss an opportunity? But every time I come back to exactly what Scott Pelley said there, which is even if you have an outside quiet investor, the people that say, I'm going to give you a couple $100,000. I believe this is almost philanthropic. I want my money back eventually, but this is in part because I believe in what you're doing and it makes me feel good to invest. And I really want to do, and I'll be a silent partner. Even those people at some point get passionate about a topic and they want you to do something and make an editorial call that's different. And I don't want that pressure. I don't want that pressure. I never felt that pressure that much. I have to be honest with you, working for News Corporation, Time Warner, I never felt like, man, an entire story got scrapped because I wanted to do it and they didn't want me to do it. I remember one time I really wanted to go to Afghanistan as a young journalist and, it wasn't the right time. And that's like one area where I was like, I was denied being able to do something. I don't think that was corporate. I think they just didn't want me to do it at that time. Who knows the reason for that? Or there was a couple stories where, you know, there's an editorial call made by a manager that's like, hey, that story doesn't feel right for us now. I didn't feel like that's a corporate decision. I felt like that was an editorial decision. There was never a time where someone said to me, don't do this story because of X, Y, and Z. That was one of the unique parts of our show at Fox News that I was part of, which was canceled after I left. Because that show in particular was covering just general news. So there wasn't someone leaning editorially on that show. And as I mentioned, it doesn't exist anymore. So you can just read the tea leaves there. But this is why what we're doing really matters and why I want to say thank you for it. Because is it really sad that someone with amazing editorial experience of several decades at one of the most prominent news shows in America doesn't feel like they can do the work that they feel called to do and that they have to leave? Of course that feels bad. It also is important to know that none of the stories have been blocked. So there's probably more behind the scenes there. Where I get nervous when people say, well, what, you know, are you worried about the Trump administration? Or, you know, he says such bad stuff about the press. You know, he says that all these things, like can you not be outraged? I'm like, I don't have time to be outraged because I actually just want to do good work. Outrage is for people who got time. I don't have time. What I have is the opportunity based on my experience working within corporate media and traditional media to try to build something different. And if anything distracts me from that, then I'm failing. Like what I need to stay crystal focused on is, and crystal clear on, is the importance of independent media that actually delivers nonpartisan news. The fact that you don't have 25,000 different options about that with that in a free country drives me insane. I should have more competitors. I don't. People don't want to do nonpartisan news. There's no money in it. I think they're wrong. Here we are. And you're part of building a solution in news. So thank you for that. We are in a new place in media. I think it's exciting as long as what really is prioritized in this time period is the people and not a corporate structure, a new corporate structure, a new elite class. More partisan products. There's an opportunity there. So hopefully we don't build the prisons that we've been trying to escape from, because that's also something that it's very easy to do. Muscle memory is real. So thank you for your support of Smarter News, for independent media. I don't feel worried about anybody. I don't, you know. During the pandemic, that was a lesson with the big tech companies blocking content. That was a problem. But here we are. We survived and we'll continue to. So due to your support. Without your support, I'm not so sure. It would have to be way scaled back. With your support, we're onto something. So thank you for your support. I'm very, very grateful for you keeping us independent. And I look forward to chatting with you every single week. For those of you who are listening on podcasts that may not be joining us live, you should come. You would enjoy this and you get to see the video. It's a lot of fun. And in the next several weeks, there's going to be some major changes and some more benefits for our Scoop Insiders. So don't worry. We've been working behind the scenes really hard on that and just want to make sure every move feels so big. And we've been so careful that I don't want to make the wrong move, you know, but we need to grow and we need to move and we're going to be doing some exciting things. So thank you to our Scoop Insiders for supporting us and for making Smarter News available to so many others. Appreciate you. And we'll continue to follow some of the big stories of the week. I'll be covering 100 days. I will be doing it like everybody else, but it's 100 days. Like, we have to bargain. Do you remember when it was like, hey, it's only been 30 days, folks. Let's just take it easy. Now it's been 100 days. And now we're going to dive into a couple of these issues, but appreciate you guys. Thank you so much for your support. If you have questions on any of these stories, you can always write us hello@smarternews or scoop@smarternews.com. I'll follow up next week and answer them for you when I see you then. And we'll be in May. I know. This year is just moving by. Okay. Final thought. It's a little bit of a philosophical thought, but I began with the wind. I'm going to finish with the wind. Why do you have wind? Why does wind exist? A wind exists because you have areas of high pressure rushing into areas of low pressure. And basically the atmosphere is trying to balance itself out. It's the same reason you have waves. You know, it's that motion is caused because there's a vacuum that's trying to be filled. And there's this constant push to try to balance out the pressure that exists. And in that way, I love the thought of wind and waves because it's this idea of constant motion and this pursuit of constant balance. And that's what I think a lot about when it comes to the news, is just a balanced perspective. So thank you for being here again. Have a great week. Please make sure to send in your questions, and thank you for your belief in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Sherry says it's 7 months until Christmas. Sherry, Christmas list. Don't get into the holiday season. We haven't even gone through May. All right, guys, have a great week. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.